So, good evening, everyone. Was quite a surprise as I opened my eyes. We were three, and now we're more. It's my first Thursday since I returned from holidays. I've seen some of you already, or spoken with some of you already. Roshi and I were speaking just before, and I was saying I just really didn't quite know what to talk about. And as I was sitting, I just thought it's really, it feels like trying to make sense of what we do. Trying to put all these pieces together. Because there are so many ways to just sit on a chair. And when we just sit on a chair the way we do, we're not just sitting on a chair. We come with an intention, we come with a particular practice, we may sit with a koan, we may sit with a question. We, all of us online, have been sitting and practicing for a long time, we've been on retreats. And so it's sitting becomes just one part of the practice and one aspect of a coherent symphony or painting or whole, and I'm very much and specifically aware of that. Because also, when I teach in these institutions, when I'm do not talk about Buddhism and it's just about mindfulness, I always feel that if I just stick to what we usually do in a mindfulness training, it misses some of the parts that we do. It's a different, it has a common ground. But it's expressed very differently, and maybe some parts are missing compared to what we do. I've been reading for the past couple of days the new book from Stephen Batchelor, called Buddha, Socrates, and Us. And as he has been doing for some time now, and I very much agree with him, he keeps insisting on how much this is an ethic, what we do is an ethical path. It's not just to gain a new personal skill, become better for just myself, just to be more relaxed. We know that it's so much more, and we experience that. I always feel that we experience that so much on retreats with the Sangha. And kind of a key point that runs through the Buddhist teachings. Not a key point, it's even more than a key point, it could be almost reduced, to one particular word that appears in the Pali Canon, which is contingency, realizing contingency. In fact, in one of the, if you remember, I think we've studied that in the study group on the simile of the elephant's footprint, the whole story about the elephant's footprint. At some point in the text, it says, "One who sees contingency sees the Dharma, and one who sees the Dharma sees contingency." Contingency means when one thing arises, something else happens. But in Shakyamuni's understanding, it's also that understanding reveals us as autonomous beings, that we are able to act autonomously. I mean, not autonomously, but we can do things right here, right now, that will also impact what arises. So there is a sense of freedom that comes with it. I was hesitant to say autonomous because it's also, we are very much related. It's like both are true. We are autonomous agent, but we are also in the midst of all these conditions. So we're not just totally autonomous. And as we sit, I feel this is one thing we experience. We sit with that. We sit with that contingencies. We sit with what arises. As one of the vows says, about reality is boundless. I vow to see it. And we keep seeing things that keeps unfolding just in front of our eyes, in front of our consciousness, or our consciousness captures what keeps arising. Sounds, perception, mental states, everything. So again, like this practice, if we practice it in the spirit of that soil, is we really experiencing the contingency of life. And in the book, he mentions, it's really, I hadn't realized that Stephen Batchelor mentions the fact that there is only one in the whole Pali Canon corpus. There's only one text that is solely addressed to lay people, to a lay person. All the rest, there's like mostly monastics, or it can be Brahmins or priests, and or mixed bench of people. But there's no text that, except for one, that actually addresses concerns of the lay people. So I was today, as I was a little bit desperate, it was like, what am I going to talk about? I read that text because I was also very much intrigued. What is in that text? So I wanted to share that with you, and it's actually, it's very, I did find it very inspiring, actually. And it will, as you see, it will go back to that idea of that really that question of ethics, and basically the question behind it is how to lead a good life, how to lead our life, not even a good life, how to lead our life. And that, so it comes from the Nyingi Nikaya, or also called the Long Discourses of the Buddha. That this is the collection, and it's the 31st discourse, and it's a discourse to Singhalaka, a man called Singhalaka. And the story goes that he, Singhalaka, is this young man that is lost. He lost his father, and he's doing basically a little a service for his father by himself. Like he's paying, how do you say, he's performing a little ritual for him, a little ritual where he bows to the six directions. He honors the six directions, the six directions being north, south, west, east, zenith, and nadir, just below. And Shakyamuni is just walking around, and he sees this guy, and he asks him what he's up to, and he sees, and the guy says basically, "Well, I'm honoring my father. I'm performing. I'm paying homage to the six directions." And he says, "No, that's not the way to do it. It's really not the way to do it. It's not the proper way to do it." So Sigalaka asks him, "So what should I do?" And so how the question is, how should one pay homage to the six directions? And to that, the Buddha starts to say things that you will recognize if you've attended a Jukai ceremony. He says, "Well, first of all, you have to abandon the four defilements of action, which are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying. So you pay homage to your father, basically, by not killing, not stealing, not indulging in sexual misconducts, not lying. Four things to abandon." And then he continues and he says, "Well, basically, and also not doing evil from the four causes." And these four causes are attachment or desire, ill will or hatred, fear and delusion. And again, these are things we are very, very, very familiar with. Third aspect, he says, you must not follow the six ways of wasting. And under that, he says, so this some of these items are a little bit seems a little bit curious if you read them to start with. He says, "Well, addiction to strong drinking, that we can understand, and drugs, basically, any intoxicating substances." Then he says, "Hunting the streets at unfitting times." So, I mean, I guess we can imagine at the time of the Buddha, if the streets probably, or the little roads may be very dangerous, and you may end up fighting with someone or being killed or whatever. Another one was attending fairs or attending festivals. I guess all kinds of things happen in festivals. Can get crazy, I don't know. Gambling, keeping bad company, and habitual idleness or laziness. Things that, what is a healthy life for us? What kind of things, what kind of actions should we implement or follow in our lives in order to feel like we're not, wasting our life. So you pay homage to your father by basically living an ethical life. And then the second question that the Sigalaka asks is like, so how do to which Gotama answers how to protect the six directions. And there I find it extremely interesting because he transforms the he gives a different meaning to the six directions that the Sigalaka was first referring to, which was east, west, north, south, zenith. And he says, basically, think of it as the east is for mother and father, the south is for teacher, west is for wife and children, north is for friends and companions, down, nadir is servants, workers, helpers. And zenith, spiritual teachers, or he says ascetics and Brahmins or priests, right? He sees this person who performs rituals that has a certain meaning, and he offers a different meaning, which I hear as really just like much more relatable. And also the content of what he gives, again, it's about, I mean, I say again because I feel I always repeat that thing about the importance of Sangha. It's about interpersonal relationships. It's about relationships. How to protect the six directions. And then he goes on details. I'm not going to go into that, but he goes on to what it means to basically protect your mother and father, to protect your teacher, to protect your wife and children, to protect your friends and companions, to protect the servants and the workers and the helpers, protect the priests or the ascetics or, spiritual individuals. The only text that exists in the Pali Canon that addresses the concerns of lay people, Shakyamuni answers by saying, by giving indications about what, about the content of an ethical life. And in that content, really kind of the cornerstone of it is relationships. And again, I insist because I do find that there's also a takeaway from us is like the freedom that he takes to transform a ritual for the ritual to become much more meaningful also. There is someone that came for the first time last night at the evening meditation that I hold at my house, and he's a piano teacher, and so we sung the vows at the end, and he said, could we do harmonies on the could I sing on with harmonies?" And I said, "Well, I mentioned what Dale is doing with and he started, singing differently and." And it's beautiful. I mentioned also Tenke Roshi, who does this very creative, very creative take on rituals, on services, to make it more meaningful, to make it more engaging, to make it more alive. I remember during, I think, I don't know if it was one retreat or one talk, or we talked about the meaning of, I talked about the meaning about what's on the, what symbolizes the different symbols of what we put on the altar, you know, the water, the flowers, and all that. Frankly, I mean, we can give all kinds of meaning. I don't know what the historical, you know, if there is a true meaning, but we can certainly find meanings, you know, find meanings that speak to us. Like, what does the water symbolizes for us? Or the various ways we can experience bowing also. During the summer retreat, I was doing a retreat with Gen and I had already noticed that Michel Dubois Roshi is really doing this whole thing with a stick of incense, where, and I started doing that, and I really, really like it. It's like when holding the incense, really just looking at the Buddha at the same time, like looking at the incense and just in line. But he's doing another thing that systematically is also he kneels down to the altar when he offers incense. I mean, just like whatever we do, what is, again, going back to that idea of what's the coherence, what's the underlying meaning and engagement that we have in our the underlying meaning of our actions, yeah, the engagement. Then kind of a variation at the end of the discourse to Sigalaka, you know, in the koans, suddenly the person is enlightened, or suddenly they have a realization. Here in this case is suddenly the Sigalaka says, well, you know, I'll become one of your disciple. It was very clear that it brought something to him. And the images that actually he gives, Sigalaka, what Sigalaka says is quite beautiful. After all the explanations that Shakyamuni gave him, he says, oh, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who had got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place. To bring an oil lamp into a dark place. Suddenly, just there's light in there. We can see. It's like suddenly it makes sense. Or to set up what had been knocked down. It reminds me of this image about the city, you know, that Shakyamuni feels. He says he like it's as if he has found an old path that hadn't been taken care of, and that road leads to an ancient city, and so it's about time to restore it. This is what he discovers. I mean, that's the image he gives about the Dharma, about the Noble Eightfold Path. And so it's, you know, it's as if to bring an oil lamp into a dark place so that those with eyes could see what was there. And so then he says, you know, accept me as a lay follower from this day forth, as long as life shall last. So it's a really beautiful, beautiful story that I do find it very inspiring for us to reflect again. How do we embody this practice, you know, this our last vow, the Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it, and what does it mean to embody it, and what does it mean on a very concrete level in terms of action? And at the same time, what I always find very refreshing and also very puzzling is it's a very, very broad framework, and it's not as if for every single situation we had an answer of how do we need to respond. It's extremely broad. And every situation is different. And so, you know, even we had endless discussions even within this Sangha about not killing, and what does it mean not killing, and the precepts, and eating meat and not eating meat, da 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 da, and it can go on forever. So it's not as clear cut, it's never simple, and yeah, we are autonomous agent with freedom, and but rooted in this intention, in this all these intentions of not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconducts, not lying, etc., etc., trying to move away from attachment, ill will, fear, delusion, etc. This is a very general framework, yet it is a framework of understanding in which a key component in terms of the how do we do it is really just like the practice of sitting. Though you also realize that in that text he never says, you know, you should sit every day and you should contemplate. He's talking to a lay practitioner that probably has all kinds of other things to do than just maybe he has no time to sit. Yeah, maybe I can stop here. If you want to share something or ask questions or comment.
Good evening, everyone. I find that question, how do I embody the Dharma? I feel it very strongly. It's a very powerful question. And it really, I feel it's a question that puts me right at the heart of my life. Yeah, it's there's this feeling of takes me right to the core, the center of my life.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's something in it that I feel there's a. What can I say? In the two figures that in the two characters that Stephen Batchelor depicts, Gotama and Socrates, he says basically both of them are obsessed by one single question, which is, what is it to lead a good life? And as they search for it, it's not that they find an answer, like a definite answer of this is what it is. Maybe Plato, this is also, and if you've studied philosophy, it's like the image Plato gives about Socrates as if he has found like a particular scheme, particular answer to that. But this is Plato that depicts Socrates this way. He never reaches any conclusion, and he stays in this state of what is called in philosophy aporia, just like a sense of I don't know, not knowing, really not knowing. And this is why Socrates is called the wisest man in Greece, because he doesn't know. He doesn't know. At least he doesn't know. He knows that he doesn't know. That makes him the wisest man. And there's a little bit something like that I feel in the Buddha, where, he, again, maybe afterwards the way he was depicted, like, we have all these things, the Eightfold Path, and everything is very structured and all that. But there is something that I feel that has to do with with a quest, with a constant questioning, with a I don't know, with a sense of the situation is so moving all the time and I need to adjust, and the best I can do is have very broad guidelines, going back to my intention. But it's like, what do I do? What do I do? It's a constant koan. It might, I feel at times, I can understand that it might feel very disconcerting. How do you say disconcerting? Disconcerting, Debbie? Disconcerting, you say that? Yeah, okay. Disconcerting. And at the same time, what a space it gives. Yeah. So yeah, embodiment. How do I embody? How do I? But I feel we can only be clear, we can be a little bit clearer with that question if also we're a little bit clearer with what is it that we want to embody? Yeah. Claudia.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Because I'm at a different. Yeah, okay. I'm happy to see you all because I was not with any of you this summer. So I'm happy to see you. And that's exactly what I want to say is that I think this is the first summer I'm like far from everybody, and I'm not going to meditate in any place. I mean, not with a sangha, not in a session. So I had this thought that I was choosing something else. I mean, I was going far from the sangha and from the zen and I think this is a. I think my summer was like, I mean, the practice was so strong and was so present in my summer, like more than ever. But I couldn't help it. It was not because I was choosing it. It was not because I was making things particularly like, I was not thinking. It was like that. It was part of me. It was my attitude. I could see. I don't know. I could see it in my attitude. I could see in my discussions. I could see that in what I was choosing to do. Even I think it was helping me. Like I went for a week in a festival of documentaries, and it was this huge day. About Gaza, and it was a super tough day for everybody. Very, very tough, because we saw film that they were filming since 2 years in Gaza from the people from there. So it was really, really moving. I mean, more than moving, it was crazy. And even that, when I was that part, and even this day, I could see I was watching these films in a way that I couldn't help. It was part of me. And I don't know. What I want to say is sometimes you don't choose it. It's because you are practicing all day and it's becoming part of you. It's really something that even you don't even think of it. It's like, I think it's modeling you in some way. I don't know. It was a strong feeling this summer. And I just want to share something too, because you were talking about the rituals, like things. And I really try to think that rituals are not important. But this morning when I went back to my yoga practice with my group of yoga. And it was very, very early in the morning, and we always chant the beginning mantra, and it's so short, and it was so powerful. Like I couldn't help it. It was powerful. It was not because I think I like rituals or anything. It was just it's like we were singing just one voice, and it was strong and it was loud, and it was everybody gathered at this moment. It's very short. Okay. And it was very strong. And I was in it. And even if we didn't choose it, we didn't think to do something like this, but it did happen. It was, everybody was like moved, like almost crying because it was strong. And okay, so that's what I wanted to share. So two things I wanted to share. And I'm happy to see you.
Thank you. Yeah, Debbie.
I'm happy to see you all too. It's such a pleasure. This the part that Sangha and being in Sangha plays in the practice for me is really, really strong right now. It was very strong this summer. And I think I was in the same room as Carla, and Carla was kind of Upset was a bit too strong, but she was annoyed that we weren't having a show. It's kind of like, this is awfully serious and we don't have any rehearsals and we're not singing and dancing. And it's kind of a lot of work, basically, if you're not singing and dancing. And I agreed to a certain extent. However, because we weren't, you know, being silly in the afternoon, this is going to sound strange. I got a lot of work done, or it was a very serious time for me. And all of the little interactions, all the things that can be so annoying in the kitchen, particularly, I wasn't in the kitchen, fortunately, because a couple of times I went in there, I thought, oh, I'm so glad I'm not in here. But anything can be anything, you know, pass me this, or you've got my cushion. It could just any little spark thing that sort of, I'm not getting mine. Somebody's taken my spot, my position, my happiness, my whatever. We don't have any, I didn't have anything else. It's so blown out of proportion that it's so visible. It's amazing. It really is. I mean, it's just such a magnifying glass of, I want to be a good person and keep my temper and try to do what I'm here to do and everything. And every 5 minutes, it's fucked up. I mean, every 5 minutes, I'm not that. And it's really interesting. So I don't know exactly what you said about Sangha, but I agree in any case.
Yeah, I read this, it's, again, in Stephen Batchelor's book, he quotes Xenophon, the philosopher, and he has this expression about the company of good men or the company of good people, and this is a training in virtue. I always feel that so much, and I mean, especially in retreats, like you are with people who are there to turn the light inwards, work on themselves, do their best, you know, just really willing to courageously look into what's going on. And even if, yeah, there might be some frictions, might be some tension, might be, you know, some bad words, but there's work happening there, and we train in virtue. We train in becoming better, yeah, more awakened, better, yeah, people. Better, I don't like that word, but like, you know what I mean, yeah. Refuge in the Sangha, yeah. The three treasures, Dharma, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Yeah, this relational aspect that the text mentions, and really he covers. I don't know who is actually thinking about it. I wonder who is left aside, you know, mother and father, teacher, wife and children, friends and companions, servants, workers, helpers, you know, priests, ascetics, monks. Everyone is included in that, you know. This is how we protect the six directions. This is how we lead a good life. This is how we embody the Dharma. Taking care of that. Protect. Care. Taking care. Care. Yeah, Krisha. Yes, you're on.
Hi, good evening. Na entrada? Sorry, my kid is looking for a key. Okay. Na entrada? Okay. Sorry. I have to help her. I'm sorry.
Okay.
1 minute.
Contingencies. Not sure if we should wait for Krisha to come back, or we are anything else that comes up.
Sensei, what's the Stephen Batchelor's book you were mentioning? I didn't. I arrived
Oh,
late.
it's Buddha, Socrates, and Us. It just came out last week. It's this one.
Because the first word I got when I came online was contingency, and it's a very important word in one of his other books that I'm proofreading it, a translation that José Eduardo did many years ago. It's another book, but that word is very, it's the first word I heard this evening.
Sorry.
Yes.
No, I'm not sure if I lost it. Maybe I lost it, but I remember a bit. It's about embodying and the stuff that I respectful could say that Joa Sensei told us. I already shared this with you, I think, about a shift in the practice somewhere last in the middle of this year, before vacations, about me ending taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the Sangha, in the Dharma, and taking refuge in the Sangha. And then I shifted to I'm Buddha, I'm Sangha, I'm Buddha, I'm Dharma, I'm Sangha, and trying to really embody it. And at first, it was really difficult for me trying to be Buddha because I felt, I don't know in English, a bit ashamed, like, not Buddha, what am I saying? And really try to connect and touch my, I am Buddha, but to try to feel it, it feels so awkward. And now that evolved a lot, like of course at the end of a meditation, I can bow to Buddha Dharma and Sangha. Also sensing that it's a bit of myself. And now I was thinking when listening to all, as I'm a bit Amy Roche, or a bit Joao Sensei, more with Amy Roche, I felt, no, I'm not. Yeah, but I am. And when you tell us this kind of Dharma talk, which I like very much, the Pali Canon, the books and your references, but I don't, and I think they are really important for me to take form, because a lot of times when we are meditating, in sometimes we have stuff, I'm sorry for the English, it arises, we really don't know what is happening, what, and that really helped me to direct, think, but not so much embodying. But I really like to know. It's really important for me to know. I was thinking at this beginning of the year, maybe I should reread some Ajahn Chah and those books I have. And I think this is just a share. Oh, I remember other stuff. And Amy Roshi at our first Dharma talk ended, if we let it go, we let go suffer.
Let go what?
Suffering, suffering.
Oh, suffering.
Yeah. And I also think if we drop, or every time I drop, it's much easier to embody Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And yeah, that's my beginning path again in the rentrée in September. Very happy to see the people I haven't seen last week. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Krisha. I think we're running out of time. Yes, it's 9:25. Juan, can you do the, or someone else can do the vows?
Yeah, I can do it. I have the bell here.
So okay. Yeah, I can do the bell.
Okay.
You have the bell?
I have the bell, yes.
Oh, you have the bell.
I have.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing and listening. Thank you.